Hello, you are listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. This episode of The Sower is a video and audio recording of a panel from our March 2026 conference in Omaha. The title of the panel is Virtue and the American Founders. We'll hear first from the panel chair, Ethan Alexander Davey, and then from three panelists, Dennis Durst, who will present Founder and Physician, Benjamin Rush and the Health of the New Republic, then Jonathan Den Hartog with John Jay's Prudence and Virtue in the American Revolution, and finally, Nick Blanda presenting A Vigilant and Manly Spirit, Founding Era Efforts to Promote Republican Virtue. Here's the panel. Enjoy.
My name is Ethan Alexander Davey. I teach political science at Campbell University. I'm also on the board of directors of the Ciceronian Society. I'm going to introduce our panelists today, and then they will present their papers in the order in which they appear in the program. So first we have Dennis Durst, who is a professor of theology at Kentucky Christian University. He is the author of two books, Eugenics and Protestant Social Reform, and The Perils of Human Exceptionalism. Next, we have Jonathan Den Hartog, who is a professor and chair of the history department at Samford University. He is the author of Patriotism and Piety, Federalist Politics and Religious Struggle in the New American Nation, and a co-editor of the volume Disestablishment and Religious Dissent, Church-State Relations in the New American States, 1776 to 1833. And then last but not least, Nick Blanda is a second year doctoral student at Hillsdale College. He received his bachelor's degree from University of Maryland. His research interests include the history of American conservatism and the relationship between politics and technology. So Dennis, you're up first.
Thank you, and welcome everybody. My full title is Founder and Physician Benjamin Rush on the Mental, Moral, and Religious Health of the Republic. Until recently, one founder and signer of the Declaration has been underrepresented in the historiography of the early Republic. His name was Dr. Benjamin Rush, 1746 to 1813. Rush was a founder of several culture-shaping institutions and a reformer of others. He contributed to important advances in the early Republic's mental, moral, and religious health by his rigorous action and his written works. This paper argues that Benjamin Rush blended an ecumenical yet evangelical piety with an enlightened compassion toward persons on the margins of society and humane reforms of care for those with mental illness. Due to the death of his father when he was just five, Benjamin Rush was raised by his mother. His religious heritage included Baptists, Quakers, and Anglicans. For most of his life, Rush identified as a Presbyterian. He was sent to Maryland to study under Reverend Dr. Samuel Finley, who would later be president of the College of New Jersey, aka Princeton. In the confessional Presbyterian tradition, his education centered on twice daily readings from the Bible, prayers, and memorization of the shorter catechism of the Church of Scotland. While Rush and his mother once intended Benjamin to become a lawyer, Finley urged him to fast and pray about the possibility of studying physic, which was the term for medicine at the time. This advice led to his decision to study medicine. Looking back around 1800, Rush wrote this, "I now rejoice that I follow Dr. Finley's advice. I have seen the hand of heaven clearly in it." Also formative to Benjamin's spiritual ethos was Philadelphia Presbyterian minister and trustee of the College of New Jersey, Gilbert Tennant. Tennant had been a promoter of New Light Presbyterianism during the First Great Awakening. He had castigated Old Light intransigence with a 1740 sermon, then 1743 pamphlet, criticizing the unconverted ministry. 2 decades later, however, as he was influencing Rush, Tennant had mellowed. He came to promote a 1758 reunion between Old and New Light factions. 2 sermons in 1759, he took as his text, Christ, Beatitude, Blessed are the Peacemakers. The mature Tennant evinced a mediating ethos. He saw the peacemaker as a medium between the dangerous experiences of criminal laxness and rigorous severity. by which the church's unity is broken. Rush's later ecumenical navigation of friendships with persons of various denominations mirrored Tenet's peacemaking tenets, heard by Rush at Second Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. In November of 1766, Rush sailed for Liverpool, England, arriving soon thereafter at his destination, the University of Edinburgh. Here, he forged lasting bonds with several other students of medicine, also from America. His travels in the British Isles involved scientific, moral, and intellectual formation. His religious views were shaped at Edinburgh by Reverend Dr. John Erskine. He met and dined with a skeptic, David Hume, whose history of England Rush admired. In September 1768, he observed medical dissections and attended lectures in London, visiting hospitals and meeting several notable physicians. He encountered in England some prominent clergymen, including William Robertson, the famed revivalist evangelist George Whitefield, and got to hear John Wesley preach. He set out for France in February of 1769. Here he met several physicians, academics, scientists, and philosophers, including Denis Diderot, the encyclopedist and skeptical philosopher. While in Paris, observing medical facilities, he was scandalized by the treatment of the insane. This was his first experience observing, on his account, half-starved, naked, and unkempt humans in heavily barred prison areas, chained to floors and walls, soiled by their own excreta, and subject to whippings. The shock influenced Rush's later activities, I believe, in establishing needed reforms in the care of the intellectually disabled. He returned to New York in July of 1769, soon leaving for Philadelphia to begin establishing medical practice. He perceived that he was too feebly attached to Presbyterianism to have any claims on them. Interaction with various denominations in Europe had led him, in his words, to consider all denominations of Christians with a more equal eye than I had done in early life. Rush turned to the caring of the poor in Philadelphia, and he piously ascribed the blessings of his life to God's favor due to his willingness to serve the poor. His vision of public universal education also saw the benefits of religious instruction. In 1798, writing, "As medicine sometimes lie many days or weeks in the body without being felt, and before they take effect, so does moral and religious instruction. Years after being administered, it produces good effects." Rush held friendships with those whose religious beliefs made him uneasy. One was his friend Thomas Paine. In his autobiography, Rush wrote a note on Paine's death in 1809, stating, "He wrote his Common Sense at my request. I gave it its name." Rush, however, lamented Paine's intemperate and otherwise debauched private life, and expressed disapproval of the mischief of Paine's book, The Age of Reason, in perverting numerous persons from the Christian faith. Though Rush and Thomas Jefferson had a firm friendship beginning with the time of the Declaration, Jefferson's writings on Jesus shocked Rush. One biographer states, "Rush was too devout a Christian not to be stunned by what he considered Jefferson's blasphemy. Such included denials of Christ's divinity, miracles, and resurrection." But despite disagreements, Rush corresponded with such figures and welcomed them to his table. His friends and sources included atheists, Unitarians, Christians, Jews, Native Americans. Rush kept himself current with various streams of thought, later historians associated with the Enlightenment. One historian notes that Christian intellectuals of this period drew on enlightened thinking in order to preserve the spiritually and ethically valuable parts of religion while downplaying or discarding those elements that were intellectually and or morally unacceptable. Church membership for Rush was a variable. One biographer notes that he moved back and forth no less than four times between Episcopalian, Presbyterian, and Unitarian faiths. He further maintained pews in a number of congregations at the same time so that he might visit the nearest one should he desire communion with his Maker during rounds. His autobiography indicates his theological justification for the variety of Christian groups. He wrote, "It would seem as if one of the designs of Providence in permitting the existence of so many sects of Christians was that each sect might be a depository of some great truth of the gospel and that it might by that means be better preserved." This relaxed ecumenical approach to religious variety was arguably a distinctly Pennsylvanian ethos at this point in history, consonant with its founding on religious tolerance by the Quaker William Penn. Benjamin Rush possessed a passion for social reform that extended into every conceivable corner of society. One historian observes, "Rush's involvement in voluntary associational activity, which stemmed from his religious orientation, marked his most characteristic political contribution to the early republic." Rush wrote pamphlets and helped form societies for abolition, temperance, military medical reform, the establishment of hospitals, establishment and founding of professional medical societies, and educational colleges. He lobbied for universal public education, including that of females. Although his influential book on the care of the mentally ill only got published a year prior to his death, its impact on the field was profound. According to a recent biography, as a pioneer in treatment of the mentally ill, Rush developed an early form of psychotherapy, occupational therapy, and medical treatment for mental illness a century before Freud. Biographer John Kluse describes Rush as one of the earliest American physicians to advocate humane treatment for the insane. Though a man of science fully aligned with many Enlightenment principles, Rush referred to his faith and his Christian values repeatedly. His autobiography devotes a section to religious principles. He espoused an evangelical piety that bespeaks the generation following the Great Awakening. Heather Vasek writes that Rush approached diagnosis and treatment simultaneously as a medical professional and a committed believer. The faith of Rush may be demonstrated readily from his writings. Voluntary statements of faith are sprinkled throughout his autobiography and his mental health manual. He wrote, "My only hope of salvation is in the infinite transcendent love of God, manifested to the world by the death of his son upon the cross. Nothing but his blood will wash away my sins. I rely exclusively on it." In 1790, he wrote, "Works of mercy to the souls and bodies of men, these are the means of grace." Though as an Enlightenment-educated person, he was wary of some religious beliefs of the past, as they had harmed the care of the mentally infirm, he did not think religion itself was to blame. He wrote, "The understanding is sometimes deranged through the medium of the moral faculties. A conscience burdened with guilt, whether real or imaginary, is a frequent cause of madness. The latter produces it much oftener than the former." To Rush, then, science and religion were in need of harmonization. He analyzed the intersection of some forms of religious belief and hypochondriasis. He noted the following among enthusiasts in religion: that they are the peculiar favorites of heaven, that they see and converse with angels and departed spirits of relations and friends. They're favored with visions wherein future events are revealed, and even that they are exalted into beings of the highest order, including they are the Messiah or a member of the Trinity. Rush observed that in the past such persons had often been fined, imprisoned, mutilated, even killed. But he said, "To the influences of the science of medicine we are indebted for teaching that these opinions are generally as devoid of impiety as an epileptic fit, and for consigning by that humane discovery the deluded subjects of them to the cells of a hospital instead of a jail, to the hand of a physician instead of the hands of the last officer." 20 years earlier, Rush was adapting to his role as a new professor in the Institute of Clinical Medicine. He called for specialized care for those who were mostly hidden away, chained in dank basements of jailhouses or hospitals. Biographer H.G. Unger reveals that by 1792, after a visit to one jail, Rush expanded the scope of his demands to include reforms in the treatment of the insane. Upon investigating their treatment at his own Pennsylvania hospital, He discovered patients lying in their own excreta, half-starved, whipped for violating hospital rules, and even as the guards charged fees to curious passers-by to walk through and stare at or even poke the helpless maniacs. Rush was incensed. His pointed, vocal, and sometimes public demands for reforms were finally met. Unger describes Rush as charging down to the hospital cellar, where he ripped whips from the hands of aides and ordered them to unchain all but the most violent patients. He then also began gathering stories of mental patients, including his own son. It would culminate in 1812 with his landmark book, Medical Inquiries and Observations Upon the Diseases of the Mind. Rush was not satisfied with the mentally ill being confined to prisons. He also did not think ordinary hospital care was sufficient. He thus urged the establishment of specialized care for this category of sufferers. His diary noted, in March 1, 1792, the lower house of Pennsylvania Assembly had voted to allot £15,000 to build a madhouse. Rush ruminated on human mental capacities. The powers of the human mind appear to be arranged in a certain order, like the strata of the earth, he wrote. They are thrown out of order by the fall of man. The moral powers appear to have occupied the highest and first place. This ordering of the mind partook of the same influences that would result in 19th century transatlantic movement known as phrenology, the study of the skull to ascertain personality traits and disorders. For Rush, the brain was the seat of the mind, and his book treated both physical and mental causes of insanity, what he called mania. Whereas earlier figures such as Cotton Mather had ascribed mental and physical illness primarily to sin and moral disorder, Rush gave attention to both physical and mental causes of the illness. The methods to be used with the more difficult or intractable patients, as described by Rush, including modes of coercion to be employed when other methods fail, included the following. Confinement by means of a strait waistcoat or of a chair, which I've called the tranquilizer. This is a chair that kept the head in a box. Pouring cold water under the coat sleeve so that it may descend into the armpits and down the trunk of the body. And if all else fails, Rush stated that it will be proper to resort to the fear of death. Well, by 21st century standards, these methods range from strange to abhorrent. This list must be understood against the backdrop of harsher punishments Rush was trying to avoid. He concluded his analysis, by the proper application of these mild and terrifying modes of punishment, chains will seldom and the whip never be required to govern mad people. It would be several decades before many of these methods would indeed be abandoned. One major criticism of Rush in later accounts was his embrace of bleeding as prescribed treatment. His book on mental health promoted bleeding as a treatment of many mental deficits, much as he had prescribed it for physical ones. Historians of medicine view this harshly. Charles Strozier writes, he had the quack notion that bleeding was appropriate for everything, from the yellow fever to mental illness. His tranquilizer chair hardly changed the shape of modern psychiatry. In fairness to Rush, however, it must be observed that bloodletting had been the standard practice for 2,500 years of medicine and itself did not abate in standard practice until the 1870s. During Rush's day, there were two rival schools of thought on the practice of bleeding. Rush himself successfully sued a newspaper editor who accused him of killing his patients through the practice. In short, I think we should avoid the approach to history described by John Tosh as a presentism that exhibits a tendency to underestimate the differences between past and present, to project modern ways of thought backwards in time, and to discount those aspects of past experience which are alien to modern ideas. We need not defend the practice of 18th century medicine, but must examine how it compared with standards and practices at the time. The historian must recognize that the importance of medical inquiries is difficult to overstate. Brodsky observes that this work was so complete and so unique a study of mental diseases that it remained the only comprehensive American study on the subject for 70 years. The founder and physician devoted his last years to the study and care of one of the most vulnerable populations in the New Republic, those whose minds had strayed from reality. One way of assessing the importance of Benjamin Rush to the founding generation is to examine the esteem expressed by his peers. He brokered a reunion between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, famously. Though he was a public figure, Rush also worked in the background to broker alliances he thought were vital to the health of the fledgling republic. Upon receiving the news of Rush's death in 1813, Adams wrote to Jefferson, "I know of no character, living or dead, who has done more real good for his country." Some historians find Rush to be a frustrating character to comprehend. Altshuler and Bilodeau aver that Rush was complicated and contradictory, verbose and eloquent, sensitive and at times maddeningly obtuse. His twin impulses of enlightenment, sensibility, and evangelical faith indeed only add to the complexity inherent in accounting for his character and worldview. But one indicator of his stature may be discerned from the fact that the American Psychiatric Association in 1965 placed a portrait of Rush on the organization's official seal, with a bronze plaque on his grave in Philadelphia declaring him the father of American psychiatry. For this founder and physician, physical, mental, moral, and religious health were interwoven. Genuine care for the suffering, in order to be truly enlightened as well as Christian, had to care for the whole person. Rush's enlightened evangelical endeavors may help reinvigorate a renewed focus upon the very troubled field of mental health, even today. Thank you.
Well, good morning. I'm grateful that people came out for the 8 a.m. session. I'm also grateful for Ethan for taking the time to chair our session today. So with that, so here we are celebrating America's 250th birthday, or as I'm in want to encourage everyone to use, the semi-quincentennial, right? It just rolls off the tongue. So in light of that, I want to start us off by taking us to the Second Continental Congress, maybe early 1776 in Philadelphia. And of course, at the Congress, each colony was delegation meets by, or sits by its colony, right? It's organized by a colony. I want to point us to the New York delegation and point out one of the members of that delegation. It's John Jay. John Jay is not tall or imposing a physical presence, but he has a sharp nose. I think that stays consistent throughout his life. Very intense eyes and a formal business-first demeanor. When John Adams was first introduced to John Jay at Congress, he recorded that Jay was a hard student, right? That meant he studied hard. He was a grind when it came to academics and to legal affairs. But a good speaker, I think that bears out. 1776, he's only about 30 years old. He's a young professional, and maybe not surprising given Congress's makeup, he's a lawyer. Look, maybe he's chatting with an older delegate from New Jersey. That would be his father-in-law, William Livingston. Now, in this esteemed Ciceronian audience, Jay's name might resonate and might come up with something like, well, he did contribute several of the Federalist Papers along with Hamilton and Madison. John Jay is first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Jay is the negotiator of the Jay Treaty. But I want to suggest that his contribution to the Revolution is even more wide-ranging than that. It really represents 27 years of unbroken service, right? Almost every founder took time out at some point. Jay did not. And so I want to start just with a glance at his resume to prove his significance and to familiarize people with Jay. We don't have time to unpack all of this, but if I say something and it pings your interest, well, bring it up in the Q&A. I'd be happy to talk about that. But I think throughout and at all major turning points throughout the struggle for the new nation, Jay worked, he collaborated with many of the other well-known founding fathers to set a course for success. So we've put him at the First and Second Continental Congresses. He's initially cautious about American independence. He's not a radical demanding independence, but he's a moderate warning about moving too hastily. But he did support independence, and he works heartily for it in the state of New York in all kinds of ways. Back in Congress in 1779, Jay became the president of Congress. And there he had to coordinate with the commander-in-chief of the army, George Washington. There they built up a connection that would last for 20 years. And I think Washington always looks to Jay with respect and cares about what he thinks. Congress next sent Jay to Europe as an ambassador to labor in Spain. Franklin has had success in France. Jay, why don't you go to work in Spain? It doesn't go so well. It's actually a very hard posting. He struggles there, but then after Yorktown, he is sent to Paris to negotiate the peace treaty, right? So we think of Jay there with Franklin, with Adams, also Henry Lawrence at the end. But I suggest that Jay is one of the most important negotiators of the Paris peace treaty. It's a dogged persistence and savvy bargaining that I think characterizes him and his work. Returning home in the 1780s, Jay serves as the Secretary for Foreign Affairs under the Confederation government. And in that position, he's largely managing the Confederation government, almost like a prime minister, not exactly, but similar. And he corresponds. We have great correspondence of him with major diplomats in Europe like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Moving to the late 1780s, he clearly believes that a need for governmental reform, constitutional reform, was in order. He's not at the Constitutional Convention, but he approved of the proposed 1787 Constitution, and he worked to see it happen, right? So he does contribute to the Federalist Papers, right? Fewer because of both sickness and getting caught in a riot. But he also writes his own standalone efforts to gain ratification. He's also at the New York Ratifying Convention, and I think he's instrumental in ratification in New York, one of the key locations, key disputed states. With the new government in place, Washington appointed Jay as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, so Jay has to labor to set the court on its firm footing. No, he's not John Marshall, but I think he's important in setting precedents. When war with Great Britain again threatens in the mid-1790s, Washington turns to Jay again, sending him to negotiate the treaty that bears his name. And it does avoid conflict. The U.S. avoids war with England. It's bitterly debated. It causes partisan strife. But I think there's a logic to it. Returning home, Jay found that he had been elected governor of New York. And he served there for two terms. There, his key legislative victory was signed into law the phased ending of slavery in New York, right? So Jay is anti-slavery. And then even after retirement in 1801, Jay served the nation through supporting many private cultural and religious endeavors. I'll highlight the American Bible Society, where he was the organization's second president. With such a long and varied career, Jay's story tells us he was a necessary, I might even say indispensable, statesman during the Revolution, providing unique services. Now, thinking about Prudence and John Jay, I've been poring over Jay's writings more than a decade, and keeps counting. But one key concept that keeps emerging in Jay's writing is his emphasis on prudence. So for today, I really want to dive into that. Now, of course, thinking about traditional understandings of prudence, we find it operates as a complex of ideals. Growing out of classical, medieval, and early modern accounts of ethics, in one of whom is, of course, Cicero, right? So I think appropriate for the Ciceronian society. Prudence is one of the cardinal intellectual virtues. It represents practical or applied wisdom. So it's an individual virtue that the individual must cultivate and then a political virtue as it's deployed in the polity. Jay reflects on this in a letter to one of his daughters. He writes, prudence is one of the cardinal virtues, right? He just acknowledges that, and well deserves our constant attention. The longer we live and observe what passes in the world, the more we become sensible the value and the necessity of prudence. It's generally acquired by experience rather than precept, right? I just really resonate, experience rather than precept. As a personal virtue, it has to be embodied by an individual statesman, and only when the individual has acquired that can he or she apply it in a prudent manner for the good of the community. And that's what Jay is looking for. And Jay sprinkles his correspondence in his writings with appeals to prudence throughout his career, some in public documents. In 1779, he writes a circular letter to the states as president of Congress, and Jay warned that, be mindful that the brightest prospects may be clouded and that prudence bids us be prepared for every event. 2 decades later, as governor of New York, Jay declared, this is an interesting and eventful period. Very important and impressive are the circumstances and considerations which render union, prudence, and energy essential to the welfare and safety of the United States. And then he offers a prayer. May the great author and giver of good counsels dispose and enable our governments and people to fulfill their respective duties wisely. In this setting, it was the danger presented by French threats to the United States that required wise, prudent, and timely responses and preparation. So in the public realm, in his public writings, Jay clearly saw prudence as a responsibility for those in positions of authority and for the common citizens. I also see Jay writing about prudence in his private correspondence. To a friend, Lindley Murray, Jay wrote, the theory of prudence is sublime and in many respects simple. The practice is difficult and it necessarily must be so. So theory versus practice. The idea might appear simple and straightforward. We could articulate it quickly, but the challenge is always applying it in a given situation. In fact, the difficulty of prudential action would leave Jay thinking that few would be able to master it, right? You can articulate it, but can you actually do it? Similarly, Jay wrote to British abolitionist William Wilberforce. They actually carried on a multi-year conversation with this description of prudence. To see things as they are, to estimate them aright, and to act accordingly is to be wise. Let me repeat that because I think it captures it so well. To see things as they are, to estimate them aright, and to act accordingly is to be wise. True wisdom had to both view things accurately and then assessing the situation, direct actions in the proper way to achieve desired ends. And reading this, thinking about this, it really triggered a quote from Abraham Lincoln 50 years later that I think captures something similar of this prudential insight. Lincoln says, if we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it, right? And that's the House Divided speech. Overall, I think Jay's politics throughout his life intended to view that world accurately and to act in accord with that reality to achieve the best ends for the public good. In the interest of time, I kind of go into the theory of prudence, and we can discuss that later if we want. My one point here would simply be there's a more modern or contemporary ideal of prudence than we might see in someone like Machiavelli, where prudence is simply the rational achievement of your amoral ends. And I just want to say Jay is not in that vein. And I can flesh that out. But I think Jay is moral and rational, not amoral and conniving. So my next step then is I want to consider, where did Jay develop these ideas, right? So if prudence as a virtue is prominent in Jay's thinking, where does he get them? Where does it come from? And I want to argue two routes: his educational background and his faith. For his education, we should point out that Jay, after receiving private tutoring, matriculated to King's College in New York, today's Columbia University. There he studied with one of the most learned ministers of the day, the American Samuel Johnson. Right, what was that? The American one. As others have pointed out, the Colonial College's curriculum was based in a classical grounding. Like, we can't forget that. It assumed knowledge of Latin and the Latin classics, right? People are expected to know that coming in. And then it inculcated a growing knowledge of Greek and Greek texts as well. So, for instance, when American pamphleteers signed their anonymous pamphlets, of course, they reached for classical pseudonyms, Publius, Phocion, Fabius. Through coursework and extracurricular clubs, the students practiced debate. And so they applied deliberative rhetoric to argue various sides of moral questions, right? This was how their learning advanced. And the capstone course in most of these colonial colleges was a course in moral philosophy, taught usually by the college president, who viewed it as the final piece of a student's education to reflect morally and apply it for issues that they might encounter. Now, these intellectual commitments that Jay learned at King's College practiced well with the practice of faith that he had as a devout Anglican or Episcopalian, right? There's that transition after independence. He regularly participated at the main Anglican church in New York City, Trinity Church, at a time when, well, Manhattan was large enough to offer many other temptations, but Jay was a regular churchgoer. That attachment to Trinity Church would last for many years. He would serve on the vestry, and he would be active in the church and in the emerging Episcopal denomination. So he's going to church meetings and corresponding with a number of bishops. Further, I think these principles that he's learning at school and in his religious life would accord well with certain forms of 18th century thought. The space existed for a constructive engagement with moderate forms of thought that we might call enlightened, right? I see all kinds of these resonances with the first paper today. And I want to assert that the British Enlightenment was much more moderate than its French or continental peers, so we shouldn't just label everything as all enlightenments is the same. The discourse that was most discussed in colonial North America was the British Enlightenment. In addition, the continental pieces that Jay picked up were often very legalistic. The law of nations, or the laws of nations, especially as expressed in Hugo Grotius or Amer de Vettel. And they advanced an updated view of the law of nature and the law of nations. And finally, the discussions around Republican political theory, John Trenchard, Thomas Gordon, the independent Whig essays, right, which they signed, of course, Cato, did not necessarily oppose moral or Christian commitments. Indeed, the very language of virtue was a principle that connected the classical, the Christian, and the moderate Enlightenment and republicanism. Jay then grew up in a mental world that harmonized classical, Christian, and modern Enlightened perspectives through a shared interest in virtue, right? Virtue is the center of that Venn diagram. And so his life and writings reveal a continued working out of these principles. And I think you could look at many of the specific actions, which we don't have time to do today, but specific policy choices are applications of prudence. Why does this matter for us? I think these ideas matter significantly, as they help us think about the American Revolution in three ways. So I want to offer a scholarly interpretation, an ethical lens for the revolution, and then maybe even a practical level for 2026. On the scholarly level, thinking about the moral debates and the focus on virtue in the revolution can redirect how we narrate the American Revolution, what we choose to emphasize. Here I'm making an appeal for a greater consideration for the debates around virtue in the American Revolution. Like, I think this is a place to really dig down. Rather than having disappeared in the 1770s, the concerns about virtue and moral questions remain vital for many American patriots. So rather than portraying the revolution as simply a populist movement or a secular movement, the revolution was a movement of ideas which retains significant space for moral reflection and Christian reflection. So I think that needs to be a part of our story. On the scholarly note, I want to take one moment to engage with a recent work, Cody Cooper and Justin Dyer's work, Classical and Christian Origins of American Politics, right? Political Theology, Natural Law, and American Founders. As their title suggests, they see a continuation of natural law thought in the founding and portray the revolution as in line with those classical and Christian traditions. So as my presentation suggests, I want to largely agree with that and echo what they've said, but I also want to extend their claims just a little bit and redirect the purposes of their argument. So I hope this will be seen as a friendly engagement with what I think is a really great book. Through thinking about John Jay's use and engagement with prudence. So the extension comes in advancing Jay as a more significant figure in the intellectual world of the revolution than has been given attention. And even in that work where Jay is mentioned, especially for his diplomacy, but I actually think Jay serves their argument much better than they recognize, that he is a strong piece of evidence for their claims. Jay strengthens that argument. Then I also want to take their argument and apply for a little bit more historical reflection than what they offer. And so if we see the clear strains of classical and Christian thought, along with a modern Enlightenment, channeled as a deep reflection on morals and virtue in the revolution, I think that changes how we should characterize the revolution historically. Without claiming that the revolution was solely a Christian revolution, yet we can see how Christianity and that concern for virtue informed the revolution and informed how the founding as a whole drew on multiple strands of thought and was not limited to simply a liberal account of man and nature. This is where I'm going to pound the podium, right? Rather, the moral category of virtue, through prudence, shaped the movement for revolution as a whole. So, historical reflection. Secondly, Jay's use of ethical categories enables us to deploy a moral reflection in conversation with the American Revolution. Here, I would want to put Jay in the category of, right, a virtue ethics, almost, right? And so I'm channeling Alistair MacIntyre in After Virtue and his other writings, which calls for a reflection on virtue within a historical tradition, right? I think MacIntyre does both of those pieces. Since the American Revolution is not only part of, but we might say central to the American political tradition, the individuals in that period can become conversation partners with us to renew our capacity for moral reflection on virtue, right? So not only a historical piece, but a contemporary piece of ethical and moral reflection. In passing, I just want to say this is not a moral analysis to pass judgment on the past in kind of a Whiggish way. We are not simply evaluating the founders by our contemporary standards. Rather, we're welcoming them into a broader conversation of moral reflection. Now, in this particular case, Jay's life and writings can help us sharpen our understanding and appreciation of prudence as a rational virtue and the one most necessary for active life in any setting, particularly for statesmen, but I think it's applicable in lots of conditions. Without being too polemical, prudence has perhaps been lacking in governmental administrations, not only in the current one, but in several previous administrations as well. And I think I want to be bipartisan in that critique. General agreement, right? I think I can prove that. To live wisely and well in the world, we need to deploy prudence in our personal and our public lives. So there's an ethical component that Jay can spur us to. And finally, I do think this is my biggest claim. I do think that how we think about morals, virtue, prudence, and these classical virtues in the American Revolution helps us think about not only the founding, but the American regime itself, the American endeavor. If we accept that there's a central concern for virtue, then we can trace it back to a series of inputs, including the classical, the Christian, and the Republican. And if that's the case, then we should not talk about the revolution entirely in terms of liberalism, right? That's the piece I'm really concerned about, even if we append that as classical liberalism. And so I think this can offer a helpful corrective to several groups who have latched on to an account which prioritizes solely that classical liberal argument, right? First, I think this should complicate our political theory of the revolution. The center is not simply Lockean natural rights, but a broader array of moral and religious commitments. accounting for the ideals of the revolution needs to be more complex to be true to the complexity of the experience. Second, I think this analysis should serve as a corrective to popular pundits who use the shorthand to just say, oh yeah, the principles of the American Revolution, classical liberalism, and move on. Like, that's simply not the case. I'm now talking back to podcasts, I guess. The facts on the ground, dismiss it as that simple shorthand. And finally, I think this account undermines the critics of the revolution from the integralist right, who assess the revolution as liberal and hence flawed, right? If it's more than liberal, then you can't simply dismiss it, right? To describe why liberalism failed is to assert that the American founders got lucky, right? They built better than they knew. Or that there's a need for a reformulation or a refoundation of American politics. Instead, I want to assert that there is, in the complex mixture of ideas in the founding, classical, Christian, moral reflection, virtue, and prudence, the resources for renewal of contemporary ills in the founding as it existed. Now, finding that path forward will take as much prudence as Jay and his compatriots possessed. But we do well to listen to them carefully as we seek to serve in our contemporary moment. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody. I'd like to thank you for coming out early, and I'd like to thank you thank my co-panelists as well for their presentations. So the question of whether the founders abandoned a concern with citizen virtue in favor of self-interest and mechanical checks on power is not a new debate. Okay. Indeed, Martin Diamond, many years ago in his essay in the Straussian Purple Bible on the Federalist, writes that Publius is aware that his scheme involves an enormous reliance on the ceaseless striving after immediate private gains. Now, however, in a later essay, he did moderate a little bit in saying that the founders did not abandon the pursuit of virtue or excellence. In fact, the American political order rises respectably high enough above the vulgar level of mere self-interest in the direction of virtue, if not to the highest reaches of the ancient perspective, still toward positive human decencies or excellences. So the question is, why is this still relevant if this has been settled, if we've been writing about this for so long? My response to that is because new generations of scholars continue to pursue this line of argumentation. More recently, Patrick Deneen has argued that our Constitution is the, quote, great achievement of the political technology of modern republicanism. Such technology, he continues, was designed to, among other things, make us into individuals who, above all, strive to achieve our individual ambitions and desires. My response to this line of argumentation is contained broadly in 3 points. First, Publius in the Federalist does concern himself with citizen virtue. 2, Publius's concern was widespread at the time of the founding. And 3, that the promotion of virtue was handled at the state level. This can be seen in the support for public religion, laws suppressing vice, and the support of public education. Now, whether we'll have time for me to go through all of this, we'll see. Okay, so. Despite what critics like Diamond and Deneen contend, a reading of the Federalist demonstrates Publius's belief in the importance of a virtuous citizenry. In Federalist 51, Publius describes constitutional checks and balances as, quote, auxiliary precautions. A dependence on the people, he explains in the same essay, is, my emphasis, no doubt the primary control on the government. In other words, Publius's regime relies on the people rather than counterpoised use of ambitious interest and constitutional mechanisms. Indeed, Publius argues throughout the Federalists that the people are the last line of defense. In Federalist 33, for instance, he asserts that the people ultimately judge the necessity and propriety of the laws to be passed for executing the powers of the Union. If the federal government, he explains, should overpass the just bounds of its authority and make a tyrannical use of its powers, the people, whose creature it is, must appeal to the standard they have formed and take such measures to redress the injury done to the Constitution. Similarly, in Federalist 57, he argues that, above all, the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America will restrain the House of Representatives from making legal discriminations in favor of themselves and a particular class of the society. The message is clear in both passages. It falls ultimately to the people, as jealous guardians of their liberties, to defend the republic against majority and government tyranny. Ambitious interest and constitutional mechanisms are merely, quote, inventions of prudence to assist the people whenever they are stimulated by some irregular passion or misled by the artful misrepresentations of interested men. Publius can ultimately rely on the people because he presupposes that they possess some amount of virtue, despite his concerns about their reason falling victim to their passions. Indeed, his reliance on the people would be irresponsible if he did not think they were capable of prioritizing the, quote, permanent and aggregate interests of the community over their own immediate interests. However, Publius asserts in Federalist 76 that the supposition of universal venality in human nature is little less an error in political reasoning than the supposition of universal rectitude. The institution of delegated power implies that there is a portion of virtue and honor among mankind, which may be a reasonable foundation of confidence. The implication is that power cannot be safely delegated by men possessing neither virtue nor honor. More importantly, Publius argues in Federalist 55 that self-government requires some amount of virtue. He says, as there is a degree of depravity in mankind which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust, so there are other qualities in human nature which justify a certain portion of esteem and confidence. Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities in a higher degree than any other form. Were the pictures which have been drawn by the political jealousy of some among us faithful likenesses of the human character, the inference would be that there is not sufficient virtue among men for self-government, and that nothing less than the chains of despotism can restrain them from destroying and devouring one another. Put another way, men without virtue cannot govern themselves. Indeed, they must be restrained like animals. Given this connection between republicanism and virtue, I would argue that Publius's belief that republicanism is the only form of government reconcilable with the genius of the people of America implies a belief that Americans possess sufficient virtue to govern themselves. Therefore, he can rely on them to preserve the republic. Now, a survey of the state constitutions shows that Publius's argument regarding republican government and virtue was widely shared at the time of the founding. Consider the Massachusetts Constitution, which states, a frequent recurrence to the fundamental principles of the Constitution and a constant adherence to those of piety, justice, moderation, temperance, industry, and frugality are absolutely necessary to preserve the advantages of liberty and to maintain a free government. Similarly, the Pennsylvania Constitution says, a firm adherence to justice, moderation, temperance, industry, and frugality are absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty and keep a government free. While the Virginia Declaration of Rights omits piety and industry, it does state that no free government or the blessings of liberty can be preserved to any people but by a firm adherence to, among other things, virtue. In sum, the three most populous states at the time of the founding agreed that good government depends on morality. Good government was also thought by many to depend on religion. As an illustration, the New Hampshire Constitution says, morality and piety, rightly grounded on evangelical principles, will give the best and greatest security to government. Likewise, the Massachusetts Constitution states, the happiness of a people and the good order and preservation of civil government essentially depend upon piety, religion, and morality. The Continental Congress and George Washington agreed with New Hampshire and Massachusetts. In its 1778 resolution for true religion and good morals, the Congress says, true religion and good morals are the only solid foundations of public liberty and happiness. Consequently, it earnestly recommended to the states to take the most effectual measures for the encouragement thereof. Indeed, Washington says in his farewell address that of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Let it simply be asked, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, if the sense of religious obligation desert the oaths, which are the instruments of investigation in the courts of justice? Further, he contends that morality requires religion. And he says, and let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Here it is important to note the secular nature of these state-level and national pronouncements regarding the importance of religion. The founders prioritized maintaining republican government over saving individual souls. Now, before describing how the states supported religion, it's necessary to say a brief word about federalism. Those who argue that the founders did not concern themselves with citizen virtue frequently point to the lack of an explicit shape the character of the people provision in the Constitution. However, scholars like Jean Yarbrough and Paul Eidelberg rightly contend that such criticisms overlook the states. The national government was designed to have enumerated powers, while the state governments were to exercise plenary powers. The founders thought the power to shape the character of the citizenry belonged to the states. Thus, the U.S. Constitution's lack of such an explicit provision more accurately reflects the founders' constitutionalism than their thoughts about citizen virtue. Now, the states supported religion through their constitutions and laws. The New Hampshire Constitution, for example, required, quote, the public worship of the deity and of public instruction in piety, religion, and morality. Similarly, the Massachusetts Constitution required the public worship of God and of public instructions in piety, religion, and morality. In both states, public Protestant teachers of piety, religion, and morality were to lead this instruction. Furthermore, both states empowered their legislatures to require towns and religious societies to provide for this instruction at their own expense. These constitutional provisions highlight two important points regarding founding era thinking about religion. First, the idea that the government should be neutral between religion and secularism has no basis in the founding. Second, some states saw no contradiction between public support for religion and freedom of conscience so long as they did not promote one sect over another. In fact, in the 1810 case of Barnes v. First Parish in Falmouth, Massachusetts Chief Justice Theophilus Parsons argued that freedom of conscience is compatible with state support of religion. He writes, "The great error lies in not distinguishing between liberty of conscience in religious opinions and worship and the right of appropriating money by the state. The former is an unalienable right, the latter is surrendered to the state as the price of protection." While some state constitutions required public worship of God, numerous state constitutions contained religious qualifications for public office, usually in the form of an oath. For instance, each member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives was required to declare, before taking his seat, "I believe in one God, the creator and governor of the universe." Likewise, members of the Vermont House of Representatives were required to swear by the ever-living God. Meanwhile, the Maryland Constitution required a declaration of a belief in the Christian religion. Further, the Delaware Constitution of 1776 required the following oath: "I, insert name, do profess faith in God the Father and in Jesus Christ, his Holy Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore. And I do acknowledge the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testaments to be given by divine inspiration." Lastly, while the Georgia Constitution of 1777 did not require a religious oath, it did declare that, quote, representatives shall be of the Protestant religion. Now, the basis for these religious tests was a belief that religion supports morality. Indeed, a Dr. Jarvis at the Massachusetts Ratifying Convention in 1788 argued that the absence of such tests would admit deists and atheists, and therefore a corruption of morals would ensue. The states also supported religion through blasphemy laws. In 1811, Chief Justice James Kent of the New York Supreme Court defined blasphemy in People v. Ruggles as, quote, maliciously reviling God or religion. Such reviling, Kent argued, must be prevented because nothing could be more offensive to the virtuous part of the community or more injurious to the tender morals of the young than to declare such profanity lawful. Therefore, such offenses are treated as affecting the essential interests of civil society. Importantly, Kent defended blasphemy laws on secular grounds. Such laws protect the morality on which good government depends. Furthermore, Justice Duncan of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court echoed Kent's reasoning in the 1824 case of Updegraff v. Commonwealth. He writes, "No society can tolerate a willful and despiteful attempt to subvert its religion, no more than it would break down its laws, a general, malicious, and deliberate intent to overthrow Christianity, general Christianity." Further, Justice Duncan argued that those who support the right to blaspheme assist in the destruction of free government. They are far from being friends to true liberty who support this doctrine, that punishing blasphemers violates the spirit of American government, and the promulgation of such opinions and general receipt of them among the people would be the sure forerunners of anarchy and finally of despotism. Ultimately, Duncan's concern, like Kent's, is not the truthfulness of religion, but religion's contribution to good government. So, in addition to supporting public religion, the states also attempted to inculcate virtue through the suppression of vice through various laws. So state-level efforts to promote virtue, as I said, went beyond supporting public religion. Indeed, the Vermont Constitution encouraged laws for the promotion of virtue and the suppression of vice. It says, "Laws for the encouragement of virtue and prevention of vice and immorality shall be made and constantly kept in force, and provision shall be made for their due execution." The Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776 contained an almost identically worded provision. As a result, several states encouraged virtue indirectly by passing laws suppressing vice. For instance, New Hampshire passed a law so the idle poor might be made useful members of society. By neglecting the improvement of such people, the law says, the number of beggars, as well as thieves and strollers, are increased and many disorders committed. Similarly, Pennsylvania passed an act for the suppression of vice and immorality in 1779 because, quote, "profane swearing, cursing, drunkenness, cockfighting, bullet playing, horse racing, shooting matches, and the playing or gaming for money or other valuable things, fighting of duels, tend to greatly debauch the minds and corrupt the morals of the subjects of this commonwealth." Lastly, the Maryland legislature passed a similar act in 1786. The law prohibited any, quote, "free white person from working on the Sabbath." The penalty was 20 shillings per offense. Further, the act prohibited owners of slaves, servants, or apprentices from requiring said slaves, servants, or apprentices to work on the Sabbath. That penalty was 10 shillings per offense. Now, in the interest of time, I'll just briefly summarize that the founders also believed that public education helps to maintain good government. In his notes on the state of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson argued that, like Publius, that good government ultimately depends on the people. An educated populace, according to Jefferson, will help forestall the corruption of the government. In his words, every government degenerates when trusted to the rulers of the people alone. The people themselves, therefore, are its only safe depositories, and to render even them safe, their minds must be improved to a certain degree. Moreover, both Jefferson and George Washington thought education contributes to good government by teaching citizens about their rights and duties. In a report requested by the Virginia legislature, Jefferson contends that to instruct the mass of our citizens in these, their rights, interests, and duties as men and as citizens are, quote, "the objects of education in the primary schools, whether private or public." Similarly, in his first annual message to Congress, George Washington asserts that knowledge is, in every country, the surest basis of public happiness. Further, he says knowledge contributes to the security of a free constitution by convincing those who are entrusted with the public administration that every valuable end of government is best answered by the enlightened confidence of the people. Knowledge also contributes to this end by teaching the people themselves to know and to value their own rights, to discern and provide against invasions of them, to distinguish between oppression and the necessary exercise of lawful authority. That is, knowledge encourages a regime of rational and moderate liberty in which the people vigilantly guard their rights without viewing all government action as despotic. To ensure an educated populace, many state constitutions provided for public education. For example, the Pennsylvania Constitution states, "The legislature shall, as soon as conveniently may be, provide by law for the establishment of schools throughout the state, in such manner that the poor may be taught gratis. Further, the arts and sciences shall be promoted in one or more seminaries of learning." Similarly, the Ohio Constitution states, "But religion, morality, and knowledge being essentially necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of instruction shall forever be encouraged by legislative provision not inconsistent with the rights of conscience." The provision for public education in the Massachusetts Constitution explicitly connects education with rights. It says, "Wisdom and knowledge, as well as virtue, diffused generally among the body of the people, being necessary for the preservation of their rights and liberties, it shall be the duty of legislatures and magistrates in all future periods of this commonwealth to cherish the interest of literature and the sciences and all seminaries of them." especially the University of Cambridge, public schools, and grammar schools in the towns. The New Hampshire Constitution's provision for public education is worded similarly to that of Massachusetts, replacing rights and liberties with good government. Finally, Congress provided for public education in the federal territories. Article 3 of the Northwest Ordinance says, "Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged." Thank you.
You have been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us, our programs, and to sign up for our newsletter, please visit ciceroniansociety.org.